We'll get going, members. We'll bring the Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Committee to order. First on the agenda, Representative Fabian did a subcommittee yesterday afternoon with Representative Anderson, Representative Hackbart, Representative Hilty, and Representative Dill. They've come up with a list of recommendations. They had the DNR second lands bill. Representative Hackbart did the first one, which included many things, so it's kind of a small lands bill. Representative Fabian will bring it forward, and I believe we have a DE amendment that Ms. Taylor worked with. So, Representative Fabian, if you want to go to the testifier's table and bring your bill forward and then offer the amendment. I think members will wait until a little later in the meeting to talk about the week after Easter when more members are here. Ms. Lewis, are you here? Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1230 is really quite non-controversial. We had a subcommittee hearing yesterday on the different aspects of the bill, and I've asked Kathy Lewis from the DNR to be here today to walk through the bill, so I'd like to move House File 1230.
Representative Fabian, do you want to move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like, and then Ms. Lewis can talk to the DE amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Members, discussion to the DE to get it the shape and the author would like. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carried. Welcome, Ms. Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kathy Lewis, Assistant Director, Lands and Minerals Division, DNR. This is our 2011 DNR lands bill that's becoming the omnibus lands bill as usual. What the DNR starts out with is identifying lands that it would like to sell but would need legislative authority to do so because the lands border water or that they would be a direct sale. We also have boundary changes for our state parks and state recreation areas and state forests. The bill itself before you today has also incorporated bills from yesterday's hearing, and these are bills bought by authors and looking at issues particularly for sale of tax forfeited lands, and there's tax forfeited land sales in several of the counties and substantially in Carlton and St. Louis and Pine counties. I can go through some of the sections, key sections for you, Mr. Chair, if you'd like to do so, or I can stand for questions.
Ms. Lewis, you better go through it. And a number of the members here were not on the subcommittee, so why don't you go through it, if you would, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first section of the bill is a technical amendment concerning the fees that we obtain from a mineral lease on an OHV area. It's a technical identification that the fees would go back to the fund from which the lands were purchased. Section 2 of the bill is a minor change. It's a correcting the spelling of Smoky Hills State Forest in the state statutes. Section 3 of the bill is additions to state parks. We're expanding the boundaries of two state parks. One is Scenic State Park in Itasca County, and one is William O'Brien State Park in Washington County. Section 5 of the bill expands the, excuse me, it's Section 4 now of the bill. Section 4 of the bill is a deletion from a state park. This is Hayes Lake State Park in Roseau County, and it's a 4-acre sliver of land to allow a cabin owner access to his land. Section 5 of the bill is expanding the boundaries of two state recreational areas, Greenleaf Lake SRA by 4.4 acres in Meeker County, and a 40-acre parcel for the Iron Range OHV area in St. Louis County. That particular parcel is landlocked. It's covered, bordered by the OHV park and St. Louis County landfill, and St. Louis County is in favor of us obtaining that piece of property. Section 6 of the bill is an addition of 120 acres to the Smoky Hills State Forest in Becker County. That's currently already state land, and this would help consolidate management. Section 7 and 8 of the bill delete 160 acres from the Lost River State Forest and add it to the Roseau Lake WMA. These are currently state lands. Those forest and WMA parcels were designated by legislation in those units, and so we need legislation to make the change from designation. Section 9 of the bill comes from Representative Pepin, and it's a concerning conflict in two sets of zoning laws for the Dayton area for the Mississippi River Management Plan, and this helps them in their process. Section 10 of the bill is a DNR land sale for Becker County, and this authorizes the DNR to sell 6.15 acres to a local unit of government. It's a site next to a dam. The DNR will continue to manage the dam, but the local unit of government will be managing a playground picnic area for the community. Section 11 of the bill comes from Representative Hilty. It's for tax forfeited lands in Carlton County. Section 12 of the bill comes from Representative Hilty, and it is also for a public sale tax forfeited lands bordering public water in Carlton County. Section 13 of the bill is a DNR parcel. It's in Cass County, and it authorizes the DNR to sell 11.6 acres of University Trust land, and this would be put up for public sale. There is an interest by adjacent owners for use of it as a septic system, but it will be up for public sale. Section 14 of the bill is a private sale of DNR land. It's 1.77 acres. It's a little strip that separates the rest of the DNR land. There's a road going through there, and it makes more sense to provide it to the adjacent landowner at appraised value, and it would improve their access. Section 15 of the bill is a 0.4 acre parcel. It's a parcel the DNR acquired that was subject to an easement at the time. This would resolve questions between the DNR and the holders of the easement and who has what rights on the property. We would just convey them the entire interest. Section 16 of the bill is from Representative Anzlack. It's for private sale of tax forfeit land in Itasca County. That's the same type of provision in Section 17 of the bill. Section 18 of the bill is sale of tax forfeit land in Lake County, came from Representative Dill. Section 19 of the bill is a DNR parcel. It's a township cemetery located on consolidated conservation land, and we'd be authorized to do a private sale. Section 20 of the bill is DNR land. It's a 0.02 acre parcel in Otter Tail County that borders Eagle Lake, and this would resolve an inadvertent trespass by the adjacent owner. Section 21 is public sale of tax forfeited land bordering public water. This came from Representative Hilty. It's in Pine County. That's the same type of provision that you find in Section 22 and 23. Section 24 came from Representative Dill, and it's private sale of tax forfeited land in St. Louis County. And also, likewise, that's Section 25 and 26 is also from Representative Dill. Section 27 is a DNR parcel. This is Watonwan County, and this is a piece of property that is currently a wildlife management area. It's a former railroad line. The proposal is to convey it to the county for use with the regional trail. The DNR would be reserving a conservation easement for public hunting, prairie management, and seed harvest. And the land sale provisions are effective the day after final enactment so that the counties and the DNR can proceed with the sales. Are there any questions?
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In order to better understand, since I I'm not familiar with all of these sections, is there a summary of the amount of acres and the approximate valuation of the tax forfeited land that's listed for sale, and then also the other state land, and then the purchase of new property by the state? So in those three categories, the total acres and estimated total value.
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the DNR land total sale acres is 120.69 acres on the list. The bill does not actually authorize, does not provide the appropriation for the DNR to acquire land. The expansion of the boundaries allows us to acquire land if there's funding provided to do the acquisition of the land. There was it's about 70 acres that we are the boundaries are being expanded for DNR outdoor recreation units. I do not have a total for the tax forfeited lands. Those all were combined last night. But there is a fairly substantial acreage on the Carlton and St. Louis and Pine counties. They are looking to have some significant land sales to help them raise revenue. And actually, that's where the fiscal impact would be the most, and they don't have that impact either. As to the valuation for the DNR land, some of these parcels that the DNR is looking at is conveying to local units of government for minimal value. For the parcels that we do have, we don't have an appraisal yet, but we would appraise them. But we did an estimate in the Senate side, and we have about $16,000 in revenue for the DNR parcels as an estimate at this point in time.
Representative Quam.
Just a two-part follow-up. One is, how much of the 120.69 acres is being conveyed to a government entity? In other words, how much is going to private, and how much is going to, you know, is going to be in the tax rolls, and how much is going to be government? And then the other thing is, what are, when you expand the boundaries and don't purchase the land, what are the implied and imposed restrictions on the utilization and use of that land that isn't purchased but is within the areas of the extended boundary?
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, for the DNR land of 120 acres, it'd be easier for me to just kind of list you for which ones would be out in the private sector. Cass County is 11.6 acres. Douglas is 1.77 acres. Another Douglas is 0.4. And Otter Tail is 0.02. I think it might be helpful to realize that some of the counties have, the county acreage is actually ones that are benefiting the public too with the use of the playground or the recreational trail. The second part of your question just escaped me. The use of the boundaries of the parks, Mr. Chair, Representative, the boundaries themselves will not restrict the activities for the people owning the private land within the park boundaries and the state forest and the state recreation areas. They do not have restrictions on their use because it's within the boundaries.
Ms. Lewis, do you use eminent domain to ever take that private property that's in within the boundaries of state parks but not owned by the state?
Mr. Chair, representatives, the DNR buys from willing sellers. We have a specific provision in law that we cannot do condemnation authority except if the legislature gives us for a specific site. On a few occasions, the legislature has given us specific direction that we have authority to acquire for a specific site, such as, I think one example would be the McQuaid Road access on Lake Superior. The legislature enacted a law saying that. But otherwise, in 84.0274, it provides that the DNR cannot exercise condemnation authority without specific legislation.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lewis, early on, when the lands bill was first being talked about, you had an overview and a summary. Maybe it would be good for the committee for you to do a summary of the lands bill as it now exists with the additions that came to the bill yesterday. And you could send this out to the members. That might help Representative Quam.
Well, Representative Fabian, I think we kind of just did that.
All right.
Do you want to expand it in any respect?
No, I just thought if it was helpful for the committee just to do a short summary of the different sections of the bill. It might be helpful, that's all.
Okay, let's go to questions if it's okay, Representative Fabian. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lewis, I understand the sale of lands when you began to the playground, you know, public use again, and to the trails. But for the sale to private holders, and it's lands bordering on waters, do you have specific statutory or other written criteria that you use in making a judgment call whether to sell these lands?
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, The statutory authority, of course, is that in 9245, all lands bordering public waters are withdrawn from sale. So we need legislation to sell the parcels bordering public waters. The question you're getting at is also, how do we make a decision to bring a proposal forth to ask for legislative authority to sell bordering public waters? And one of the factors we look at for a direct sale to an individual is the ones you normally see are inadvertent trespasses. And we look to make a decision on, do we believe that it was an inadvertent trespass, not a willful trespass? And we also try to keep the area as small as possible. We also look at what kind of trespasses. Is it a shed that can be moved, or is it a house or a garage that would be very costly to move? So we look at those types of factors.
Representative Wagenius.
Okay, given the fact that there is a statutory prohibition and that you are making these recommendations, and it just feels to me like these recommendations are coming faster and faster, it seems to me that you need to have written criteria in your office from maybe an order from the commissioner with the criteria that you use. Otherwise, these are going to seem to be very arbitrary and capricious. I'm not saying that these are, but without some specific criteria written down and of common knowledge, I think there's real danger here that it will appear that we are doing favors for some people and not others. And I think that's a danger that anybody who is elected has to worry about, and anybody who is a commissioner of an agency has to worry about.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lewis, the expansion of the state park boundaries, can you kind of remind us again what prompts these, and maybe what prompted these particular ones? Maybe Representative Fabian wants to answer it. Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I can speak directly to the Hayes Lake addition of 4 acres.
Representative Fabian, which page is it on, or which section?
Section 4.
Thank you.
Okay. It's the deletion of the page 2. This is on the far northwest corner of Hayes Lake State Park, and there's an existing property line, and as many of you are aware, the DNR resurveyed property all around the state, I assume, but certainly in northern Minnesota. And as a result of the survey and the new technology that's available for doing surveys, the barbed wire fence that goes along the northwest corner of Hayes Lake State Park, which has been recognized as the boundary of the park for 100 years, or at least on the property, found out through the new technology that, quite in fact, that's not the boundary. So in essence, what this legislation does is it moves that boundary back to where the fence is at this time, and it allows for the cabin owner to have his cabin be on private land, which everybody thought was private land at one time, but because of the new GPS surveys, the boundary has been moved to the west and so forth, and it caused problems for that landowner. And I want to thank the DNR for working with the cabin owner up there, because it's been, like I said, for many, many years, it's been thought to be private land. And they sold it back to the cabin owner, the 4 acres, at assessed market value, basically. And the cabin owner is happy, and the DNR is happy. And I'm happy.
Ms. Lewis, I think Representative Drazkowski was referring to additions to state parks. Could you direct us to where they are in the bill, and if you could give us an explanation?
Mr. Chair, certainly Section 3 of the bill is the additions to state parks. The first one is to Scenic State Park. It's 29.9 acres. What it would do is provide access to Isaac Lake, and it's a shoreline acquisition. William O'Brien State Park is 13 acres. It's a piece of property that currently borders the park. It would provide a trail area continuation and alignment for the park. Ron Potter with the Parks and Trails Division is here to provide more details about those parcels if you need to do so. But basically, the Parks and Trails Division every year looks at parcels that are privately owned within state parks and also looking at potential sales and looks at the interest for identifying what's the best natural resource use for the area and the state parks. And we can defer to Mr. Potter for more details if you'd like.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a general question. Does the DNR have a guiding plan, if you will, for these areas, or is it just, the local folks say, and I guess I'm not curious only about parks. I'm curious about the state forest expansions and the wildlife management area expansions, et cetera. But does the DNR have a guiding plan for these, or is it simply the folks locally next to one of the state parks say, well, you know, it'd be nice to have access to that lake next to there, and DNR, by the way, could we add that to the boundaries of the park? Or what if we ran this trail up over this hill? It would really be nice. Maybe just to give us a little understanding of that would be helpful.
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the department has two items that might be appropriate. One is we do biennial acquisition plans where the department in each division looks at and establishes criteria for lands that would fit the natural resource purposes for those types of management units. And so those are developed every 2 years, and then with the extra funding that comes in the other year, we do also revise those plans. There are also management plans that are developed for the different outdoor recreation units. That's part of the requirement in Chapter 86A. The management plans are developed for the different outdoor recreation system units. So each of the different divisions of the department do have different plans developed for different units. And we do have some representatives here from some of the divisions that can go into more detail if you'd like about the plans they do develop.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Just quickly related to that is, do we know if the additional costs that might be encumbered in some of those changes in those plans are part of those discussions?
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, one of the issues has been about the long-term management costs for DNR lands, and the legislature required a report from the DNR, and that was just published in December of 2010. And that one looks at the costs for our management and the continued acquisition of lands and looks at those issues, and it's a very good report that addresses some of your concerns.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am familiar with that, but I'm wondering about the specific, when these specific parks or forests or other areas, and they're looking at, as you mentioned, the biennial plans, is the cost of that particular area and those additional, you know, the additional access to the lake or the trail extension or whatever, mm-hmm. Is part of that discussion at that micro level, are they considering the additional costs encumbered for those contemplated changes?
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I would actually have to defer to each of the divisions because I'm not privy to their discussions of how much they discuss those costs as they work through their proposals. It's obviously a factor for all of us to look at our costs, but I would have to we'd call on the division directors to say how do they handle that discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Lewis, I wanted to say I'm impressed that you have, I believe, 11 or 12 sections in here that are sales. And I certainly am glad that you're working with situations where it's a private sale, or I think Representative Hilty's got some more significant ones that, if I'm not mistaken, there's some public auction sales in here. And I really think that's some good things. In Representative Hackbart's House File 55, if I'm not mistaken, you took, it might have been a full quarter section out of Afton State Park that you actually, in my district, looked and said it no longer fits within the parameters of a state park. So there's significant ups and downs. I'm not sure if there's a lot of significant ups, but there are some, and I just think I want to tell the DNR thank you for doing that. I think you've heard from us that we want you to be doing this kind of stuff, and I appreciate that. And so, Representative Fabian, thank you. I noticed there's one Representative Fabian, maybe you know what it is. In your district, there's a addition to a wildlife management area. Do you know what is the issue there? What are we actually acquiring some private property, or what's the case there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you take a look at Section 7 and 8 on page 3, I assume you're talking about number one. Section 8 says the addition to the state wildlife management area.
I was.
And then right above that, there's a deletion from the state forest. In essence, what's happening there is that's the same property, and it's just being reclassified. Okay, so there's no exchange. There's nothing with regards to a sale or whatever with the state land. The state is just simply reclassifying from state forest to WMA.
Thank you. And Ms. Lewis, you need legislative action to be able to do that?
Mr. Chair, yes, this is consolidated conservation area land, and the legislature designated these parcels in the state forest and the wildlife management area through legislation. And so we need to have legislation to make the switch.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lewis, Mike got a couple questions regarding Section 27, the sale in Watonwan County, where it's going from it was railroad bed, and it's been in DNR's control, and now it's going to the county. I believe you mentioned that DNR is going to retain some of the hunting easement of some sort. I see that's not part of this document. Could you just kind of fill me in on how those mechanics work in a sale like that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, the Watonwan County parcel is does have the conservation easement language in page 22, lines 10 and 11. So it provides that we can reserve an easement for public hunting, prairie management, and seed harvest. This is a parcel that when the state acquired it from the railroad, we had ideas that we might expand the wildlife management area, and that has not occurred. And so through our analysis, we identified that we are willing to convey this property to local unit government, but we're retaining quite a bit of rights. And this is a kind of a new way to go for this particular parcel in this area. But it also has federal aid involved, and so the federal government has to give us permission to divest ourselves of the property, and this is part of the discussion that's ongoing with the federal government. And so what we would do is be actually retaining some rights to this property and only conveying some rights to this property to the local unit of government for the use of the property as a trip.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. Follow-up, and my understanding is that the rights you're retaining have to do with hunting, and the parcel is destined to be a trail. Is there any potential conflict there? Or?
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson. That's a great question. The trails people identified that they can set it up so that during the public hunting period that it can be done safely with the trail use, and that is common in some areas. We're also retaining prairie management and the seed harvest on this property too.
Thank you.
And if I'm not mistaken, Ms. Lewis, maybe I'll look up to Major Smith, but I believe there are trails that we do allow hunting on where it's a wider area and certain understandings, but I believe, and I think that's just a good, again, good management. Additional discussions. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, one more question on that easement on page 22, lines 10 and 11. Is that a perpetual or permanent easement?
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, that would be.
Thank you. One thing I wanted to mention, Ms. Lewis, just so it's on the tape, we do not have House File 1030 included in this bill. That was a Representative Keel bill that was dealing with an issue with the DNR and the city of East Grand Forks. Representative Fabian, Representative Keel have worked on that, and again, the DNR has worked with them, with the city of East Grand Forks. The city of East Grand Forks has interest in keeping some of the things about a state recreation area, but they want to maintain it a little different than standard DNR, and I believe you're working on a joint powers agreement, so we don't need legislation at this time. and I appreciate you working on that issue to work with East Grand Forks and just a different way of dealing with that. They were down here shortly just before they really was the flood was hitting them, but then the mayor and the administrator had to leave to head back home. Any points on House File 1030, Representative Fabian?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We do have one friendly amendment here as well, too, that came in real late. It's the A1 amendment.
Representative Fabian, I think Representative Beard will offer that now.
Yep.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the A1 amendment is a member I'm carrying on behalf of MnDOT. It was a piece, of course, I chaired the Transportation Committee. This is one that they felt needed to go in the lands bill. If you look at the A1 amendment and the map, here's what's going on down there. MnDOT, of course, is responsible for the right-of-way for the Interstate 90 bridge where it intersects with U.S. 61, and that bridge is being rebuilt. To do that, the valley, of course, is controlled by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So there's an agreement between U.S. Fish and Wildlife and MnDOT that MnDOT will convey a portion of land. You'll see it in, if you look carefully, you can see it shaded in here. Apparently, what, 1.4 acres of land to be conveyed to Fish and Wildlife. In exchange, Fish and Wildlife is going to yield land that's required to build the new bridge approaches and the ramps to Highway 61 and so on and so forth. So pretty straightforward stuff. I believe I've described it as accurately as I can. I'm looking at the MnDOT guys, and they're not shaking their heads in horror, so I must have hit it pretty close to accurately, so I'd appreciate your support for the amendment.
Discussion to the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendment's adopted. To the bill, Representative Fabian, I believe, I'm going to look for Representative Hackbart here. I believe this bill probably should go to Ways and Means. Did yours, Representative Hackbart? This has got some significant money involvement in it.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe there's any money in the bill at all.
Well, what about the land sales?
There's no money in this. That could be another bill elsewhere. Okay. Some money has already been appropriated.
Can you pull your mic down? Can you pull your mic down, Representative Hackbart? Thank you.
Some of the money has already been appropriated for some of these things, okay. And the rest of it could be in the future. But okay. There's no money connected to this bill
all right.
at all.
Thank you.
I think we can send it right to the floor.
Okay, so Representative Fabian's motion is to send the bill to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries. The bill's on to the floor. Thank you, Representative Fabian. Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Next, why don't we do quickly, we have House File 1097. It's a DNR technical bill that I'm going to carry. Representative Scott, sorry.
I just wanted to add that we probably need to add that amendment that the bill be passed as amended. Did we say that?
I'm sorry. The motion was to pass the bill as amended. We'll redo it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries. The bill is sent to the floor as amended. Thank you, Representative Scott. House File 1097. Mr. Meyer, why don't you walk through the sections, and I believe we have an amendment. And this is a motion to send it to GovOps. Mr. Meyer, it will come back here. I anticipate that there may be some more things added to it when it gets back here. It probably will serve as a vehicle for a DNR policy bill is my thought at this time. We'll load it up with a bunch of stuff. Not really, but we may put some things with it that make sense in a bipartisan way, and some will maybe discuss a little more thoroughly. It'll come back in the busy week. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the record. Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. As the chairman said, the bill before you is our technical bill, and I'm just going to walk through it with you. Section 1 deals with the peatland SNAs, and this would allow us to actually acquire them through exchange as well as gift, lease, easement, or purchase. Section 2 deals with the management plans of those, the peatland scientific and natural areas. The management plans, as it says, the language we're striking is in a manner prescribed by 86A.09. The management plans for the SNAs, we don't need a management plan because we do know there's no facilities, there's no roads, there's nothing like that in the scientific and natural area. The purpose of those units, as we've discussed previously, are to preserve the natural areas of those. So it's just duplicative language or unnecessary language, I should say. On page 2, starting on 2.3, section 3, and it carries out at the bottom of the page, is language that's similar to our firearm safety and other programs. This is for the all-terrain vehicle training and safety programs, which will allow us to, the intent is to go in line with this program, similar to our firearm safety classes right now, moving it to a hunter exam that we have. So this language will actually, you'll see we're striking language that says on 2.12 to 2.13, the commissioner shall collect a fee of $15. We're striking that, and then you'll see that further on down the line, it allows us to establish these fees by the commissioner, notwithstanding 16A. What we're going to do is the online course will be a little bit more as we develop that with a private vendor, but we're anticipating the class that you attend to be less than $15. So rather than establish these fees in statute, we're seeking flexibility like we have in other pieces of our safety training programs. And All Terrain Vehicle Association does support that change, Mr. Chair. Section 4 deals with motorized vehicle trails, and it's a clarification. You can see the language we're striking on page 3.5, from December 1st to April 1st in any year. This is language that's not needed. Actually, the following language is what we're looking for, is no use of a motorized vehicle other than an ATV or off-road vehicle shall be allowed on those trails unless authorized by permit. So the time frame is not needed in this section. Sections 5 and 6 we're trying to bring our grant programs that we have in 85 in a line with the grant programs that are in the legacy bill right now. Right, there's a mismatch of the matching grant appropriations needed for these grant programs. In the legacy dollars, it's only a 25% match. In our regional trails and our trail connections grants, it was 50%. So obviously people would apply to the one that had a lower match first and then come back to this program. In talking through this issue, we thought it would be best if they all had the same level of match. It will reduce the amount of projects we can fund, but it provides equity across all the programs. So that's for those two programs. Section 7 and Section 8, Mr. Chair and members, deal with snowmobile skipping, barring, you can see the title of the head note, barring vehicles from unsafe ice. And what we're doing here is we're striking some language that provided an exemption to certain people. If you were a member of a sanctioned circuit watercross association, if you operate a snowmobile with a silenced exhaust, or you would receive written permission from a conservation officer. The next section also deals with this, and the intent here is that to get the DNR out of the business of writing permits for these events and have the sheriffs be the sole responsibility for writing the permits for these events and making them apply across the board. Sheriff's Association does support this. We're working with Representative Dill to address some of his questions and concerns on this section, so we may need to change this when the bill comes back, or Representative Bill comes back before we finish this up, but he does have that concern, Mr. Chair. Section 9 deals with the Minerals Management Coordinating Committee, and this language here we're changing and clarifying. In line 5.2, we're striking Deputy Commissioner of the PCA and saying the Commissioner. Of course, it can always be their designee as well. And it actually was very specific in the next section here that said the Director of the United States Steelworkers of America or the Director's designee. The designee or that person could not make it to these meetings all the time. So what we're doing here, you'll see on 5.1, is striking that specific reference and allowing the governor to designate an additional person representing labor. So it could be the Building Trades Association. It still could be the Steelworkers Association. But rather than have one organization specifically outlined, we thought we would make it more generic. And section 10 there at the bottom of that page deals with the sunset of that advisory committee. And the repealer, Mr. Chair, I don't have that. Oh, you can see right here. On the back of that page, we're changing the Blakely State Wayside. We're going to incorporate that into the Wildlife Management Area unit right next to it, but because it's not, we can do that administratively. We need to take it out of the wayside designation, so that's why we're striking that language, and it'll be managed as part of the Wildlife Management unit next to that.
And Mr. Meyer, I am familiar. In a Wildlife Management Area, you can you've done it in Hastings. You actually don't allow hunting sometimes
for safety reasons and such. So you'd have the ability, if this is a specific corner or something, you can post it for no hunting as a wildlife management area. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, or specific seasons or whatever we need to do for safety or other reasons.
Thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Meyer, my question relates to the motorized vehicle trails. Driving down the road the other day, I followed a trailer that had an ATV on it with tracks. Does that have any chance of being classified as a snowmobile, or is that still an ATV? Just kind of a broad question about how you classify these different recreational vehicles and what trails they have and don't have access to.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Meyer.
Representative Torkelson, that is a good question and one that we have been debating with the user groups and manufacturers for several months now. A tracked ATV is not an ATV, nor is it a snowmobile. So it is one of those situations where industry has gotten ahead of the users and the stakeholders and the department, actually. The specifications and the operation of them don't fit in our trail system for the most part, and they don't fit on the snowmobile trails because of the two-track system versus the one-track system. So it's an issue we need to try to address into the future, as where do they do fit and how do you register them. But at this point in time, they are not considered an ATV for practical purposes.
Additional questions? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, back to Section 4, which is on page 3, you suggested that the limiting language there, December 1st, April 1st, in any year, is not necessary because they are required to have a permit anyway. It appears to me that having that language in there does restrict your ability to restrict. Is that accurate? I don't see exactly what you were saying there, that's not what appears to be here.
Mr. Meyer or Major Smith? Mr. Meyer?
No, Mr. Chair, members, maybe I might bring Ron Potter down to help me explain this as well, but it was our intent, this language dealt with where it's at. You can see the previous line from December 1st to April 1st, no use of a motorized vehicle other than a snowmobile, unless authorized by permit, lease, or easement, shall be permitted on a trail designated for use by snowmobiles. This next section is the same language but refers to ATVs, and I'll let Major Smith kind of discuss what we're trying to do here.
Major Smith, welcome. Good. Identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Major Rodman Smith, Operations Manager for DNR Enforcement. Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the language in 3.5 is somewhat useless because from December 1st to April 1st, we normally don't have off-highway motorcycles operating on our trail system, and so we normally don't have ATVs operating on our trail system. So it would only limit an ATV, for an example. It would only prohibit an ATV operating on an off-highway motorcycle trail only from December 1st to April 1st. So the rest of the year they could. And what we think happened was when laws were recodified and the proliferation of ATV trails and off-highway motorcycle trails happened, that the language in Section B was basically copied from Section A, which is the snowmobile trail, and the snowmobile trails are only open from December 1st to April 1st, so it made sense that you limit the use of other vehicles on snowmobile trails during April 1st, or December 1st, April 1st. So when you have an ATV or another motorized vehicle, and I'll go back to the ATV off-highway motorcycle example, currently it would only be prohibited to drive an ATV on an off-highway motorcycle trail from December 1st to April 1st, and the majority of operation of off-highway motorcycles and ATVs is during the summer, which is outside of its parameters. So what we did is we added in line 3.7 by lease or easement. So the majority of the, in the direction we're headed with ATV and off-highway motorcycle trails are some type of grant and aid system that we have right now with snowmobiles. So under this provision on line 3.7, if we had a grant and aid trail that was designed for an ATV, we could, through the lease agreement or through the easement agreement with the private landowner or the public landowner, whoever we had that easement with, we could authorize the use of ATVs and off-highway motorcycles. In short, what this provision is trying to do in line 3.5 and then line 3.7 is keep the ATVs on the ATV trails and keep the off-highway motorcycles on the off-highway motorcycle trails.
Thank you. Additional questions? I'm sorry, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to follow up on Representative Torkelson's question on the dual track vehicles and Commissioner Meyer's comment about those not fitting into the current statute. Are enforcement actions being taken on dual track vehicles going on snowmobile trails or other trails?
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the tracked ATVs are just starting to get a little popular in the state of Minnesota. They haven't been very popular, and Commissioner Meyer was correct. The way we define recreational vehicles, an ATV under current definition talks about three or more low flotation tires, a certain weight, engine cc's. A snowmobile has a track and skis, and so when you put tracks on an ATV, you can register it as an ATV when it's got tires on it right now, but as soon as you put the tracks on it, it no longer has low flotation tires. It no longer meets the definition of an ATV. We are starting to get people that are putting tracks on their ATVs. We haven't seen a high number of these starting to be used on our state trail system, but we have been addressing the issue, and we've been trying to address it through education at this point. And I can't give you right now any numbers of any tickets or warnings, but I could look that up for you and get that to you at a later time if you would like.
Can I ask you, Major Smith, the flotation in a tracked ATV compared to a snowmobile, or Representative Dill, maybe. I don't know if either one of you want to answer that. I'm just curious. I've heard that they do actually mess the trails up, the snowmobile trails. Is that true, that tracked ATVs do? Major Smith, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, I probably wouldn't be the best expert for that. They can have some impact on it. I think the bigger issue is the speed. You put tracks on an ATV and the speeds go down significantly that they can operate at, and I think it's more of a speed issue. I don't know if it does a lot of damage to the trail, but I'm not the trail maintenance expert. I'd have to defer to Mr. Potter from Parks and Trails or Representative Dill.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, living where I do, it's an issue. Polaris and Arctic Cat. I know that there are some people that use their vehicles because they have cabs on them. They drive them to work. My perception is that they don't do anywhere near the damage on a snowmobile trail that an ATV would do, simply because you don't have the torque going to the ground. You can't spin the tire or the tracks as much as you can with an ATV. So, you know, for discussion in the future, I think this is something that's going to have to be dealt with just because it's out there, and I'm not exactly sure how to do that. But
okay, thank you. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Representative Fabian and I are kind of a like mind on this. Frankly, the biggest problem with the ATVs is that where they do operate on the snowmobile trail, legally or otherwise, as long as they stay out of the wet areas, they really do a great service for us. In my estimation, they keep the brush down where people use trails to get to cabins that they own that are on leased land or owned land or any kind of land. I can tell you that that's where we have the least amount of maintenance on the snowmobile trail, unless it's in a wet area that they can cause, rutting and damage and things like that. And then when you put the tracks on them, and frankly, a lot of people have gone to the tracks because of that very thing, because when they use the snowmobile trail for their own purposes to get to and from, particularly from their cabins, and I'm not particularly speaking about recreational type riding, I'm talking about more destination type riding, our trail system's in great shape, and that gives us the possibility then to spend more time on other areas that are problematic rather than that. But I know that there isn't any one fell piece of action that we can take here to try and figure this all out. It's a very difficult situation. So I don't really have the answer, but just anecdotally, I'm telling you the effects of the use of those in my experience.
Representative Dale, if I could ask you, are you talking about winter or summer use or year-round use?
Well, I'm talking on all year-round. Frankly, the most people that are have cabins and need access to areas for, oh, let's just say fishermen then, people who are using the trail to, they don't, and when the snowmobile trail is has snow on it, they don't use an ATV as a rule. They use a snowmobile. But when it doesn't have snow on it, or it's in the in-between, and there's particularly frost in the ground, they'll use an ATV, and many are going to tracks for the reasons that I said. In the summertime, they exclusively use ATVs and sometimes with tracks. And so it hasn't caused us a great amount of problem. It is to concern. It is a bit disconcerting when people use them improperly. And I mean improperly, I'm not talking about specifically within the law, but I'm talking about improperly when they use them in areas where they can do damage, and from time to time do damage. And we certainly don't condone that.
Representative Fabian.
No, I'll pass.
That. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, Section 7, barring vehicles from unsafe ice, or striking language there that is exceptions to that statute, which it seems to me there may have been some wisdom in providing those exceptions for people to have what appears to be in a rather safe way the ability to use our natural resources. Why are we striking that language again?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Mr. Meyer.
It was our intent to clarify that everybody needed to contact the sheriff's office and to work with them to get a permit to do that rather than have these exemptions and have these activities going on that no one may be aware of in case there was an accident or something like that.
Representative Drazkowski?
Mr. Chair, yes. Mr. Meyer, are there any widespread problems with the existence of these exemptions for these folks who, you know, have been legally using our resources in what would appear to be a safe way?
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, Section 7 and Section 8 go hand in hand, and what we're attempting to do is Section 7 talks about barring vehicles from unsafe ice, and it gives the county elected sheriff the responsibility and the right to bar people from driving on the ice when the ice conditions are unsafe. And when you get into Section 8, gives the sheriff that authority, and then in Section B, basically, it gives a conservation officer the authority to override the sheriff's determination on whether or not ice is safe. And we didn't want to see that conflict between a state agency and a locally elected county sheriff, that the sheriff is saying it's unsafe, but then they can maybe backdoor and get a permit from the state or a CO to allow them to do something. So what we did is we struck that language from 4.12 to 4.18. And then in Section 8, underlined 4.22 and 4.23, then we gave that authority or clarified that authority for that sheriff, that sheriff can still issue that permit to do a watercross event or do some type of watercross practice session. So the authority is going to solely rest with the sheriff. It's going to be a one-stop shopping, so to speak, for somebody that wants to use it. And I know Representative Dill and I have talked, and we just talked in the hallway a little bit about the practice portion of this and people getting a permit to practice through a sheriff. And we're going to be working on some language to address his concerns, but I would like to talk with the Sheriff's Association because they did sign off on this and they supported this, and I don't want to make any changes midstream here with that they might not agree with. So we'll be working with them to make sure that the practice portion of it is clarified under that. Does that answer your question, sir?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Major Smith. It somewhat does. I'm curious. What we have here, of course, is government inserting itself to a further extent in the ability of people to make decisions for themselves, practice personal responsibility, and exercise their freedoms to use our resources. And apparently, or it appears from what I heard from you, that we have more nanny state government coming in and suggesting that people have to check in with the government, whether it's the sheriff or the DNR, before they consider going out and using our resources. And that's problematic for the people in my district to once again have to continue to, you know, have another situation where there's another permit that they have to have when they at the present time are abiding the law. Were there actual real Minnesotans, real people other than government who brought this concern forward?
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jaskowski. The issue lies around sanctioned watercross events and water skipping. And although there is no definite statute that makes water skipping illegal in the state of Minnesota, the overwhelming majority of county attorneys will charge somebody if a conservation officer, if a sheriff or somebody finds somebody water skipping, they'll charge them with what's called careless operation and possibly reckless operation. And the reason is if you're water skipping during the daylight and you're leaving tracks, and those tracks go into open water, and unknowingly at dusk and at night, we've had people that are following tracks, they're not familiar with an area, and they will follow the track ahead of them thinking that this person must have made it across this ice okay. And we've actually had documented cases where people, in fact, we've actually had families of people that followed those tracks right into open water, and because somebody was water skipping during the day. So it's the water skipping is kind of the key here, and it's not that we're trying to be the nanny state, but it has to do with the safety of the individuals operating. And so when we have sanctioned events like this, they need to have permits. We the sheriff's office is the water surface manager. If you're going to have an ice fishing contest, you need to get a permit from the sheriff to have an ice fishing contest to hold an event on the water. So we're really not changing what we've done. It's just that we're changing. We're trying to make it easier for folks to go to one person to get a permit rather than multiple agencies.
Representative Wagenius, you done?
Yeah, thank you, Mr.
I'm sorry,
Chair.
Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Jaskowski. I'm trying to get Representative Jaskowski, Representative Wagenius, and everyone. I've shortchanged Representative Dietrich a number of times. I want to make sure she gets some time with her bill. And we're gonna adopt an amendment when you and Representative Wagenius get done. We have an amendment to adopt, and then Representative Meyer, I'm just gonna lay this bill over for a little while. Well, you and I and Mr. Reinholz discuss where this bill is going to go. There's some issues.
Mr. Chair,
still have the floor. I was trying to just lay out what we got going on. Representative Jaskowski.
Mr. Chair, that's helpful for me related to this provision. If we're going to lay it over, I'd be interested in being part of those discussions.
Representative Jaskowski, we're going to lay it over for a few minutes to figure out the path that's going. So we should discuss your issue and what it is. Keep going.
Well, Mr. Chair, my issue is still there. And I did hear the major's description, and you know the notion of somebody following a snowmobile trail into open water. I understand that. That's one of the things. It's a danger of Minnesota that we do have. Because that same person who is water skipping is issued a permit is not going to change the trail. It's still going to be there. The same danger is going to occur and be present. But what I'm concerned about is we again appear to be requiring those people to go get a permit before they engage in the use of our natural resources freely under the law. Major Smith, am I missing something there?
Comment, Major Smith?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kraszewski, no, you're not.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Jaskowski, you may not have intended when you were speaking to denigrate sheriffs, but that's what I heard, and I just wanted to when you talk about other than government in a tone of voice that says that government is very bad. I look at sheriffs with great respect. I appreciate sheriffs a great deal. And I think the issue here is that if a sheriff knows that this event is going on, they'll keep their eye out, maybe post a sign, whatever. But otherwise, if they don't know, then we're putting in danger the very people that were asked to protect us, because they're going to have to haul the people out of the water that get in the water. You and I don't go and do that. So I don't want to either denigrate the sheriffs or put them or their people in further danger. So I think this is not one of those issues where we should be. Well, that's enough said.
Representative Jaskowski.
Mr. Chair, well, Representative Wagenius, apparently we can't call government government. Sheriffs are government. DNR folks are government. I have respect for both of those. I also have respect for the citizens of our state, and those are the people that we are here to represent. The government is there. These are people we hire and or elect to fulfill certain responsibilities that we see government needs to serve. And so I don't know where your offense came from, but you know, everybody's got the freedom, thankfully, to develop offense over certain things. But there was nothing intended to denigrate anybody, except to refer to government. I mean, these are branches of government that are apparently bringing forward a provision here in this bill to limit the ability of the citizens to use our natural resources. So I don't know where you come from, Representative Wagenius.
Representative Bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. When you said, this is a question to you, you said you were trying to figure out where, does that mean that at some point in this meeting we're going to be voting this bill out of here? I came in late because I was doing other bills, so I guess I don't know what's happening.
Representative Dill, we are trying to figure out the path that's going to go based on what's included in the bill, and I just need to have a discussion with staff and Mr. Meyer, and I thought I would do that while Representative Diedrich Bill was being presented.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman, once you figure out the path, does that mean we're voting it out of here today?
That was the plan, Representative Dill, and anybody that wants to delete any parts of the bill or make amendments will have a chance for oral amendments if they're simple. So I'm going to try and get Representative Diedrich wrapped up a few minutes before 10, okay, so that we can decide the path of this bill. Well, Representative Dill.
Mr. Chairman, there's a long way to go on this deletion. I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not even sure that I can go home Friday night, because if you came to my lake, you would say there's no way in H that you're going out on that lake with a snowmobile or an ATV. But I can tell you that I'm going home for the next 2 or 3 weeks. There's 9 of us that live on an island out there that are going to be traveling for the next 2 or 3 weeks. That, you know, you think we're probably crazy for going out there. But frankly, it's safe, and we've been doing it for 30 years. Secondly, is I can't yet. I thought on line 4.15 that it talked about silenced exhaust. I thought we had a law that says that every snowmobile had to have a silenced exhaust. So what does that mean? And secondly, is the problem with the county sheriff issuing the permits in St. Louis County? At least I'm told that a sheriff, that people who want to practice, that are members of a sanctioned watercross association that just want to simply practice for an event, have to get a permit. If this language is stricken, and then the sheriff, then because it has an event tied to it in this language, the way it's proposed, would then require insurance for that event, and so the problem continues to compound. And this has a long way to go before it gets to where it can be livable by the citizens that Representative Drazowski is talking about. And you know,
Representative Field, would you like to make a motion to lay the bill over while we work on it? And I think I did move it, didn't I, or didn't I?
You just do it.
Yeah, we're just going to lay the bill over. We're going to work on it. We're not going to vote on it today. That's what you would like, Representative Dill.
Well, yes, and I'm not trying to persecute the department here. I know that they're trying to work through this and make this more simpler, but when, you know, just like that ATV issue we talked about on those snowmobile trails, it's not a simple issue. And so that's my position on it. I'm glad we're going to lay it over because I think we need to do some work on it.
And I'm not only saying you, Representative Dale, Representative Jaskolski's mentioned concern, Representative Fabian. I do want to give Representative Purcell a chance. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be remiss if I didn't weigh in a little bit on this. And I'm going to bet a dollar to a dime, Representative Dale, you aren't going to water skip up there. You know where the open water is. But we got people that don't. And all over in the lakes in my district, it's dangerous. We have to protect people to some extent from their own stupidity. Sorry, we do. And the sheriffs take an oath to protect and serve, just like at a stoplight. Those open water are just the same thing as a stoplight. And we put horn screening up in many areas because we haul snowmobilers out of there every year. And there's people killed every year. So it's a public safety thing. And how we arrive at the final, I don't know what the language is going to be, but we have to do something other than just let them go. I truly believe that.
Representative Dale.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you know, I agree. We have to do everything we can to have safety. But on the other hand, is on Lake Vermilion, over 1,000 people gather at one location to water skip 2 to 3 weekends out of the year. And to my knowledge, there's never been an injury at this, and it's not a sanctioned event. It's just where families, I mean, they're having cookouts, and the kids are there, and there's airplanes on skis there. And I mean, just because it's water skipping, the people in this audience and the people in this committee shouldn't believe that this is some death-defying feat. And frankly, Representative Purcell, I have skipped water to get to my house. I had to get my tax return filed. And I think it was in 1995, and I had to go home to get a paper.
That's okay.
And so I went home to get it, and I got it successfully and came back. And you know, my wife said, "Oh, you shouldn't do that." But so, Mr. Chairman, before we go any further, I'd just like to make a motion and to delete the stricken language in section 4. On 4.12, 1.3, 1.4, 1.5, 1.6, 1.7, 1.8, and then delete the added language on 22 and 23, and I think that gets it. And then we'll be to where we are, and the bill can go forward, and I won't have a problem with it, and we can work on this and maybe come up with something that when we get another place, we can have it more refined.
Ms. Taylor, do you have that? And if you could repeat it for us.
Sure.
So delete section 7 and 8, I'm advised.
Yeah.
Over.
Oh.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members, Representative Dill is correct. If you were just to delete sections 7 and 8, that would get at what he's intending.
Okay. Representative Dill's made a motion to delete section 7 and 8. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Mr. Meyer, we are just going to lay it over. I don't know where we're at. I apologize to members, but Representative Diedrich is going to start to present her bill. Representative Torkelson will take over. How about Mr. Meyer? You and I and Mr. Reinholz for sure have a discussion, and any other members that want to be part of that discussion are welcome. Representative Diedrich is going to start to present her bill. Mr. Meyer.
Just quick, I think we had an amendment. Did you get that amendment?
No, we have not. Mr. Meyer, thank you. Members, I have the A1 amendment. It includes some citizen oversight. Mr. Meyer, to the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, this is an extension of the reauthorization of the Game and Fish Budget Oversight Committee that was in the Game and Fish Bill last year that was vetoed. The group has been meeting. They've recodified the language in a form that streamlines it and takes it from about 50 people to, I believe, about 15 or 20 people. The group does support this language, and it just reestablishes that group.
Discussion to the A1? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries. We'll lay House File 1097 over. Representative Diedrich to the House File 1353.
Good morning, Representative Diedrich, and welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Go ahead, please. Before we get going and moving the bill, I would like to just make a couple of housekeeping announcements or comments, and that is that I do have an amendment to the bill, but it did not make a 24-hour time period, and it doesn't greatly affect the bill, so I am going to hang on to it. I'm not going to move it today, but in fairness to members, I just want them to know that I do have an amendment, and what it does is it moves up a lot, many of the effective dates to January of 2012, and it deletes the very last section of the bill, which is it says that we have moved DNR staff over to this new agency. And so I just want to give people a fair warning that there are some modifications that are still in the works, and I would be happy to give the amendment to anybody in offline if they would like to, if they have a strong interest in this topic.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich. So what we are just doing some informational hearing today. Is that the intent, or are we trying to move this bill forward?
No, Mr. Chairman, I thought we were moving it forward.
So we're moving it forward without the amendment?
Yes.
I see. Okay, thank you. I just would you like me to move your bill then?
Would you please?
I would move House File 1353, and do you know what the path is for the bill? I have no help here, so...
The chairman yesterday had talked about moving it to GovOps.
We'll assume that's correct. Representative Deep will move House File 1353 to be passed on to the GovOps committee. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Representative McGinnis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the Finance Committee, and I wondered, I maybe just missed it in my packet, but do we have a fiscal note on this bill, both with and without the amendment?
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, we do not have a fiscal note on it, and I understand that this is the Finance Committee, but everything within this bill and all of my school trust lands bills are paid through the Permanent School Fund, and so it is not a direct general fund appropriation.
Representative Gaines.
Nonetheless, Mr. Chair, it has tremendous fiscal ramifications, and we have to see, it seems to me, a fiscal note on this bill. It has huge tails. So, and we, of course, are dealing with tails that we are having trouble with right now in the billions of dollars. So, Mike, it seems inappropriate to me to move this on without having the fiscal note, and so we can discuss the real ramifications that this committee has to discuss.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we can. I do have other fiscal notes from other bills that are similar to this, and this would actually have less, I think, of a fiscal note, but we can request one. I think that it's, well, I know it's a fair question. This is all, and I want to be very upfront with this, but actually I don't think that this one actually has a general fund fiscal impact directly. But I could be wrong, with the amendment, I should say.
Representative McGinnis.
We would have a fiscal note beyond general fund, though. I mean, these funds are beyond general funds, because other funds have impact on the general fund and DNR, for sure.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and hear about the bills, and hopefully we'll be able to clarify the path as we reach towards the end of the discussion. Representative Dietrich, please go ahead with the discussion of your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 1353 creates an independent administration to be located within the DNR to oversee and manage the Minnesota's school trust lands. And Mr. Chairman, because this is a public hearing and not everybody might know the school trust lands history, I want to provide just a little bit of history, and I will be brief. And as the members of the committee know, that when Minnesota became a state in 1858, the federal government granted sections 16 and 36 out of every township to benefit the schools. The acceptance of that land grant created a trust, and we, accepted the position of trustee on behalf of the beneficiaries. The beneficiaries in this case are very clearly the children of the school children of this state. This trustee relationship extends to the Minnesota Legislature, DNR, State Board of Investment, and anyone else who makes major decisions that influence the trust. It bears repeating for this discussion and any discussion that surrounds school trust lands that the same fiduciary and undivided loyalty principles that govern and govern the administration of a private trust apply to the trustees of the school trust lands and the funds that it affects. The original land grant was 8.1 million acres, and currently we own 2.5 million surface and subsurface acres and 1 million acres of severed mineral rights, which are currently managed by the DNR. This bill is very similar to a bill that we have already had an informational hearing on in this committee, except one major thing. It sets up the administration within the DNR. The response or the change for that was generated from many, many comments to me of that why would we need to have a separate agency that might be redundant. I don't agree with that, but in the spirit of compromise, I am proposing this bill. It is similar to the other bill, though, that it does set up an oversight board. This board is titled the Board of Trustees of the Permanent School Funds Trust Lands Administration. The Board of Trustees would be appointed by the governor and approved by the Senate. They would be responsible for hiring a director to carry out the day-to-day duties of managing the lands as the trustee for the state and the school trust lands. I believe that this model is necessary because we need an independent agency or an administration that deals exclusively with school trust land issues. And is with that person or that administration is highly more likely to be focused on the goals, on the trust goals of the beneficiaries. It is my belief that focus would provide better financial benefits to the trust, preserve land that needs to be preserved, and provide more revenue to our schools when we are in dire need. Today what I would like to do is address three questions here quickly. The most obvious question to me is the existing structure working? As I mentioned, it is the DNR that manages the land currently. The next question is, how does the Minnesota oversight compare to other states? And the third question is are we as a state honoring our trust obligations? So the first question, is the existing structure working? In 1905, Minnesota's trust fund was one of the top performing funds in the United States. And this is documented from research in a book by Dr. Swift. In 2010, we are third from the bottom on return of surface acre owned, and third from the bottom of return per mineral acre owned. And you have handouts, you have just been handed out three pieces of information. One is a table that has the numerical values. The other two are bar graphs, and it shows where Minnesota falls in comparison to the other states that have school trust lands still in their possession. The fund's market value and the distribution to our schools have not kept pace with inflation, while expenses have dramatically outpaced inflation. In the forestry division management, the costs are 102% above inflation, and the administrative costs are 275% above inflation. And I looked at a five-year history there. In real dollars, just in 2009, that would have meant $4.6 million in addition to the fund. It would be hard to find any business right now in America that has increased their management of their organization by 25% in this economic downturn. I also believe that there is a conflict of interest when the DNR also manages the other state-owned land and has other primary responsibilities. The goals and the objectives of the DNR has responsibilities that I believe conflict with the management of the school trust lands. To the DNR's own admission that, in fact, their actions as land management trustees are many times affected by conflicting legislative objectives, and that also is a problem for our trustee. In 1981, the Financial Audit Division of the Office of Legislative Auditor reviewed the DNR's management of our school trust lands and found, among other things, that the department had not established objectives for the overall management of the land. And I think that that was also confirmed in another legislative auditor's report a couple of years ago, is that we keep acquiring land, the DNR does, but they don't have a plan for how to manage them. So why would you intermingle our school trust lands in with that? I have serious questions about that. The report also concluded that the DNR should not have the sole decision-making authority over the use of school trust lands, and it recommended some management or oversight to be implemented. The legislature did that. They statutorily created the Permanent School Advisory Committee. I have served on that committee for, I think, three years now, and I think that the way that committee is set up and organized, it does not provide adequate oversight for the school trust lands. So, in my opinion, the answer is no. The current structure is not working. Minnesota school trust lands have suffered a lack of consistent oversight and accountability. My next question that I feel like I need to answer for myself: How does Minnesota oversight compare with other states? Well, Minnesota has retained 31% of its 8.1 million acres. More than the direct neighboring states, which is a good thing, Iowa, Wisconsin, Ohio. But when you compare it to the western states, many of them have retained between 60 and 98% of their lands. Out of 13 states, Minnesota is only one of two states that uses the same structure to staff and manage both the trust lands and the state-owned lands. In most other states, they have some sort of independent agency or some sort of a different division within the land management agency that is responsible for trust land management. There are two states, Minnesota and Washington, who actually use the same staff and facilities within the Department of DNR to manage the school trust lands and the state-owned land. While Washington's staff, the difference between Minnesota and Washington, though, is that Washington maintains detailed separate records for time and resources spent on their trust land. And we are the only state that is totally integrated with the DNR. The DNR does not have designated staff or a separate division responsible for trust land management. Most divisions do not distinguish between trust land and other state-owned land when accounting for staff time and land management. Most other states that use the land management revenue to fund the management costs have some version of an independent agency or division that is responsible for managing the trust lands. And we are even more in depth into that now, into that commingling relationship, because we have always allowed the DNR to deduct for their expenses for forestry. Actually, I shouldn't say that. They were at one time limited to $500,000 a year. But we have... We have allowed the DNR to fund the forestry costs out of the school trust land money revenue coming in, and now we also are allowing them to do that in the area of minerals, and that happened in 2007. So basically, the two major revenue areas are now charged back from the DNR. So in conclusion, Minnesota is an outlier in that area, and we should be taking some steps to make sure that we are honoring our trust obligations. And so the next question is, are we honoring our trust obligations? And Ms. Kelleher of the Minnesota School Board Association would like to address that issue with you. And I like to say when she speaks that she is truly the voice of 800,000 public school children who are the beneficiaries of this trust fund.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich. I just wanted to clarify, we did discuss with the House Fiscal staff, they're potentially a significant cost involved in this bill. So, members, we will lay the bill over, and we'll work with the author as far as determining the fiscal costs and such. I do know the commissioners here that would like to talk on this issue too, Representative Diedrich. So, Ms. Kelleher, if you want to take a few minutes to go through what you'd like to add to Representative Diedrich, and then I'd like to hear from the commissioner and hopefully allow a few minutes for questions. House File 1097 that was originally laid over will be laid over to come back after Easter, so we will not be discussing that any further today. So we have until 10 o'clock. Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent 340 school districts from around the state and over 800,000 school children going forward. I wanted to recognize Representative Quam and Representative Fabian, Representative Anderson, who serve on our K-12 committee, and really get to see in a day-to-day light how challenged our public schools are across the state. Representative Diedrich brought up a key question on what are the duties of a trustee, and I think that really gets to the crux of the matter on why school trust fund lands need to be managed with a different perspective than other trusts the DNR manages. I started off a sheet here as trustee. This is a DNR document that outlines what they feel are their responsibilities as a trustee. If you also look, you've got another document from the legislative auditor. There's a lot more information on the legislative auditor. And it's interesting, I feel, the ones that aren't included in the DNR list. And I just want to highlight those that are in the legislative auditor's report that I feel are probably some of the crux of the problem with this issue. The duties of a trustee are to demonstrate undivided loyalty, and I provided behind that trustee document toward the back a piece that the DNR also provided. And let me tell you, serving on the advisory council over the last 3 years has buried us in documents. The way it's hard to see the truth and the honesty and the integrity if, in fact, you're buried under 200 pages of paper. This document by the DNR actually lists their conflicts with other laws and other policies by the state of Minnesota. Clearly, it shows how they are not the entity, an agency, to manage the school trust fund lands. We need clear lines of responsibility and clear accountability. You know, members, we ask students to do that every day in school, and we ask our teachers to be effective and licensed. And yet we let this problem and the DNR shuffle us on to Buffalo year after year after year in. So I just provide that for your information. Other key trustee duties are to furnish information to the beneficiaries. To my knowledge, that hasn't really occurred. Preserve trust property, enforce claims held by the trust. Defend actions that may result in a loss to the trust. Members, I challenge you to look back just on this year alone, or if you want to look back any farther. How often have you heard the DNR come to the table and argue that the school trust fund land shouldn't be part of this program? They shouldn't be included. We have a responsibility to generate money off this land, and as such, that would limit revenue on these trust lands going forward. I can't remember a time that's occurred. This interest in the trust lands goes back beyond Representative Diedrich and goes back to people like Alice Segrin and Representative Barb Sikora. Representative Sikora realized that there really was a treasure here that could make a difference for kids across the state. She put aside, out of the education budget, $400,000 to look at new gravel opportunities that are around the state. Last year, the DNR returned $200,000 of that. It once again just highlights the internal conflicts going forward with the management of these lands. Members, if we really didn't feel the need for this, we would not be in front of you today. We made it clear in the statute the commissioner is the responsible party. We made it clear in statute the money should go to the school districts. And yet we have year after year after year of failure. I suggest to you today that a commissioner nor the Permanent School Trust Advisory Council should be able to decide how this rolls out for students across the state. This is the new money your K-12 schools will see for the next 10 years. The management of this fund is critical, and the transparency and the accuracy of how these dollars are expended should be held to the DNR. This bill enables that to happen. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Commissioner Landwehr, Director Kramka, do one of you want to come up and welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Landwehr. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and appreciate the opportunity to be up here today with you and with Representative Dietrich. I've been on the job now a little over 3 months, and this is one of those issues that takes quite a long time to get a handle on, and I've been ramping up my knowledge of it as quickly as I can. But because of the complexity of it, as Ms. Kelleher just mentioned, it takes some good understanding of what's going on. I will have you know out of the chute that I am 100% committed to the purposes of the trustee responsibilities of the Department of Natural Resources in managing trust fund lands. I understand that the nature of that trust responsibility may vary as commissioners come and commissioners go, but as long as I am commissioner, we will put the management of the trust fund lands at the highest possible priority. I would be quick to point out that the fund proper is not managed by the Department of Natural Resources. The fund proper is managed by the State Board of Investment. The State Department of Natural Resources manages the trust lands that puts revenue into the trust fund. So once the money goes out of the lands, it is no longer in our purview. I want to also emphasize that we operate within the constitutional and statutory guidelines that you provide us, the statutory guidelines that may at some in some cases appear to be at odds with the intent of the responsibilities of a trustee, but those are not constraints we impose on ourselves. I very much appreciate Representative Dietrich's efforts and her focus to this issue, because it is important that we keep these trust lands separate and unique and manage them for their maximum long-term responsibility. Given that, I don't think this bill is a good idea. And the reason I don't is based in part on the quality and the location of these lands. There are approximately 2.5 million acres of trust fund lands. About 1.5 million acres of that is qualified as forest lands, commercial forest lands, and yet 500,000 acres of that 1.5 million is qualified as low-grade forest lands. We also have approximately 1 million acres of severed mineral rights that also contribute to this fund. The location of those lands, as Representative Dietrich mentioned, are very much in a checkerboard pattern. If you took a checkerboard and picked out two black squares on there, that's the nature of those lands. They are scattered amongst a variety of other land holdings that include the additional 3 million acres of state land, federal lands, county lands, and private lands. The reason that's significant is because very often these trust fund lands are adjacent to or embedded in other public lands. They are not a discrete set of lands that are in one chunk by themselves. They do not typically lend themselves to being singularly managed. So having set that background, imagine this is in place, and I admit that perhaps I'm reading this wrong, but in my read of the bill, we are creating a new state agency nestled within the Department of Natural Resources, but with complete authority for the responsibility and management of these lands. In my read, that means a separate state agency. That means we have to have a separate agency that has the management capability, the administrative capability, the technical expertise to manage these lands. So what does that take? Well, it takes quite a bit. Many of these lands are state forest lands that requires foresters. Many of these lands are mineral lands that requires geologists. If these lands are managed by a separate state agency, the administration, does it mean that we have some efficiencies in personnel? I don't quite see that. That means that There will be one administration with its own foresters and geologists, another administration with its own foresters and geologists. When we have state forest land that is not trust land adjacent to trust land, we will have to have two agencies working together to do forestry activities across that line. When we have minerals rights that cross two lines, adjacent lines, we will have two agencies working to facilitate a mineral transaction on that. I don't see that we gain efficiencies in this type of a scenario. I think there is suspicion. I think a lot of what I'm hearing from Representative Dietrich and Ms. Kelleher is suspicion that the department is doing this all in-house and there is no oversight. I totally agree that we need to have an objective third party looking at this. I think part of the trust fund advisory, this permanent school fund advisory committee's job is just that. Perhaps it needs more attention, as Representative Dietrich allows, and I don't disagree with that. I am 100% amenable to having as much oversight as the legislature feels we need. The legislature has given us guidance. As I mentioned, we operate under constitutional requirements and legislative guidance that you have given us. One of those guidances is the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee. I think there is legitimate criticism that this committee has not worked as thoroughly as it should in the past. I'm committed, because that is in the statute, to making sure that we work closely with the advisory committee to get their recommendations as specified in law as to how we manage these lands and dispose of lands. And I have passed out a letter that we submitted to the Trust Fund Advisory Committee, or will pass out a letter that Commissioner of Education Brenda Caselius and I co-signed, that presents that to the committee, that we want their recommendations. We're going to ask for them to provide some specific recommendations by the end of the calendar year as to how we might do things differently. So that is the very first step that we're going to do. But even in the absence of having that direct guidance from the committee, we are already undertaking some things. One of the biggest challenges we have in the trust fund lands right now is that 86,000 acres of trust fund lands are within the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. By virtue of that federal designation, we can't do any management of that land, and that has been that way since the 1970s when Boundary Waters was created. We are actively working, and we're working under a resolution that the legislature passed last year to exchange those forest lands with the U.S. Forest Service, or receive cash payment for those forest lands that can be directly deposited into the school trust fund. We, in the absence of that exchange, we can't do any more intensive management on those lands than because of the wilderness designation. We are, for the first time, and this is a little surprising to me, developing an internal operational order on the management of trust lands. I think it is true, it is safe to say, that not everybody in the Department of Natural Resources understands the nature of school trust lands and the obligations that we have. And that is disappointing and surprising to me, so we're going to put together an operational order so that everybody in the departments, and especially those that have trust fund responsibilities, understand those responsibilities, understand that these lands are different. And finally, we're going to be accelerating some of the lakes shore land exchanges. There is a substantial amount of this trust land is lakeshore. It has been managed differently in the past because of its sensitivity to lakeshores and leasing that we've done in the past. But we will move to accelerate some of those exchanges or sales in the near future, because they will, the most benefit for the trust will be received if those lands are disposed of. So we're undertaking a number of steps already. I think one of the things we need to realize is that the great potential in the trust fund lands in the future comes not from the marginal forestry returns that we will get over time, but rather from the mineral royalties we will receive over time. We think, frankly, there are hundreds of millions of dollars of mineral royalties that can be received over the next 20 years from the trust fund lands. It will help the corpus of the trust fund substantially. That now sits at about $700 million, generates 5% for the schools every year. And the minerals management, the minerals leasing, and the minerals extraction will be the bigger contribution to the trust fund than the ongoing management of forests. I'd like to close just on two things. We need to be careful when we look at some of these facts about what is going on with the Department of Natural Resources. The handout that you got, for instance, suggests that we have doubled our minerals staff in the last couple years. We simply have not done that. It suggests that we have 72 FTEs paid for out of the school trust land receipts. We don't. That is not incorrect. It may be portions of 72 FTEs. It is not 72 FTEs. So there is, and again, we have an advisory committee that looks at that. We provide a statement every year of the expenses of the department for managing school trust lands. We'd be delighted to share those with you if you would like to see those. You know, be delighted to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, you know, this has been around most of my lifetime dealing with it. Here we are again today. Thank you. I don't ever recall. I've got some experience with trust in my family and my life. And I know that we have spirited debates when we meet as trustees about how the trust is going to be managed and what outside forces are affecting us, whether they be inflation or the cost of this or the cost of that or bonds or values. But I don't ever remember in my 10 years here in the legislature, the department coming forward and saying, wait a minute, legislature, right, you're passing a law that's going to cost us the kids money. Because a mosquito passes gas out in the middle of a 40 doesn't mean that we have to study it. And you're passing a law that says we have to study that, and that's going to cost us money. I don't ever remember that. And if I were a trustee, I never even thought of that until it was just mentioned. That the department has never, in front of me, at least as a member of the Environment Committee for 9 years now, ever come here and said that about any statute that we've ever passed, unless I've forgotten one that they have defended. And I know that you have been around a while and probably have an opinion on that.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what I'm saying is that I don't think that this bill creates the efficiencies that the bill intends. That's all I'm saying. I fully acknowledge that the legislation you pass is what we will abide by. I'm suggesting I don't think that the efficiencies and the increased revenues that this bill presumes are going to be there. And I do consider that my job as the current trustee to advise you that I don't think you're going to see additional revenue out of that.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you. I'm not sure that the bill is going to pass either. I'm more concerned about the future than a specific bill. I want to make sure we do the right thing when we do it. Whether it be this bill or another bill or a compilation of a bunch of bills. It's my impression in my service here over the years that the land that's not trust land has a higher return in terms of forestry results and receipts net than the lands that are school trust lands. And when I look at the map and I live my life where the boreal forest is and where most of the mining and most of the lands are, the fact that they're checkerboard, every piece of DNR land is checkerboard, whether it be school trust that belongs to the trust or whether it be acquired land or any land that you're managing, it's this massive checkerboard. And I don't get the part about that it's more difficult or alleged more difficult to manage the trust land, notwithstanding the boundary waters lands. I understand that argument, but the rest of them. It looks to me like it's probably just as difficult to manage all the other DNR lands as it is the trust lands because of the checkerboard pattern. And so I didn't get that part of what you talked about.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Lander.
Members of the committee, my point about the checkerboard is that currently we can operate, because the department has responsibility for lands that are trust lands as well as lands that are not trust lands. If they are adjacent, we can manage those as one parcel. And as you know, forest edges transcend, you know, legal boundaries. So a forest edge doesn't end at one section line and a different one start up the other. It makes sense to manage across property lines when you can, because it is better, more efficiency for harvest and reforestation efforts.
Representative Dill.
And last thing, Mr. Chairman, one of the things you mentioned, Commissioner, in your testimony was that really made me sit up in my seat. I'm going to go up and read the Constitution again. I think it's in Section 8. And I do not recall a provision that allows for the acceptance of a cash payment to get rid of or to sell school lands. There was an instance where there was a condemnation in Voyageurs National Park on the Captogama Peninsula. I believe it was done under Governor Anderson. promoted as his promotion back in the 70s. There was all the land that was state-owned, school trust land and acquired land on the Capitogama Peninsula. And I can tell you today that you could factor to the times of 100 the value of that land compared to 1975, what the state received for that land. It's embarrassing what we received for the land that's now inside of a national park. And to even contemplate taking money, if you look at that fund, and Representative Rukavina should be here, because he knows this stuff backwards and forwards, but I'll bet that 90% or more of the money has come from receipts from mining and a small part from logging, and that less than 10% has come from the sale through condemnations or public sales of land. And I mean, somebody said it, I can't remember who, they're not making any more of this stuff. I can't imagine that we would do something that would allow us to sell the land. It says in the Constitution, equal value. It doesn't say cash, as I recall. I stand, could be corrected.
Commissioner, I'm not going to allow you any time to answer. Sorry. Representative Quam, do you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to voice a concern. We had a lot of testimony on this in the Education Committee, and the concern is that maybe it's just coincidence, but the money seems to be all used up for the forest lands, and it doesn't seem as if the management is tracking costs, is tracking with the reality of other management, and I don't want to see the funds utilized as a pot of money for other activities, and there's that impression. If it's not, please give the committee members details to explain why, you know, when there's an increase, it all seems to be used up.
Thank you. And to that point, Representative Dietrich, thank you for bringing it forward. Commissioner, you raised some points about not agreeing on the facts. We do need to all agree on the facts. Facts are the facts. We need to get that. The one point, Commissioner, we do have to get to the point where we're willing to sell Lakeshore property. That school trust land, that's one thing we have to get to that point. And if we continue to say we're never going to do that, that's not going to work. Members, we're adjourned until after the break.
Mr. Chairman.
Am I correct on that? I will give you a minute, Representative Dietrich. We will be day and night that week, folks. So we will break for dinner in some way, shape, or form, whether it's pizza down in the cafeteria, what we're going to work on, those issues. But we are going to be going strong that week. So those of you who have not been through policy deadline will understand where we're at. Representative Dietrich, we've never been here at 6 minutes after the hour. Representative Dietrich.
One closing comment, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. Representative Dill has this exactly right. This is about the future. And I would guess 5 years ago they could have said the same thing. 10 years ago they could have said the same thing. 15 years ago, 100 years ago, they could have said the same thing. And I don't think our future is ever going to look any different until we make some systemic change. And if nothing else, one person who is the trustee with accountability and oversight with the board of directors would have the responsibility to change the future. And if not, then they would just have to go away. And we could go back to the old model of above inflation expenses.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. As we're bringing facts forward, it's just a fact for us to bring forward. One of the things that I observe is that we pay people to go on private hunting lands, DNR does that, yet we do not take money. We allow hunting on some of this, or what's that? It's not that we allow. Hunting is done on some of the school trust lands, but we do not pay the trust lands for the right to hunt. And if I were bringing a lawsuit, that would be my favorite one to take on. It would be helpful if the commissioner could bring the dollar amount that should be put into the trust fund each year for the privilege of people hunting on those lands.
The bill's laid over. We're adjourned.